So, okay, post-Newtonian is an expansion in V, so it means that when the velocity, you know, the more you go in this direction, the more post-Newtonian you are. Okay, so 2.5 pm becomes important here. And then the second effect, which is conservative, it's a tidal deformation of the surface of the compact object. So this is an effect that appears at 5 post-Newtonian. So it affects the waveform much later on when the velocity becomes large, you know, around the coalescence. Okay, so those are like physically two effects that we can probe. They also, they tell us something different about the internal structure. Well, for instance, dissipation is, for neutron stars, it's a probe of the viscosity of a neutron star. And, well, the tidal deformation is a probe of, let's say, of the equational state. It's a probe of how dense the neutron star is. And yeah, if you only believe in normal signs, then basically, well, maybe I should not say this in the perimeter. Okay. If you don't expect, you know, modifications of gravity, if you only think that, okay, everything is jar, everything is standard model, okay, then the main end goal of the gravitational wave science is to measure the equation of state of neutron stars. Okay. So of course we can do much more fun things, you know, if we believe in new physics, but okay.
To do
what?
The main goal is to measure tidal log numbers.
The main equation of state for neutron stars is when for neutron stars, right? Because if you believe in jar, okay, everything else is just jar. You're just measuring jar, like you're not learning anything, right? That's why I said, yeah. If you only believe in normal science, okay. Yes. The gravitational waves, for instance, right? Themselves, they get absorbed, right? For instance, you can think of this as, let's say, a black hole. Black hole absorbs everything, including gravitational waves, right? Okay. Now, you know, there were some great measurements. So we have had a neutron star merger, GW17-0817, and some of these parameters have already been constrained. For instance, here I'm showing you, you know, the constraints from one of the LIGO papers. On the tidal deformability parameters for two neutron stars, and you see that some, you know, certain, so different lines here, they correspond to some particular models for the equation of state, so they are already ruled out, and, well, there is still a significant fraction of parameter space to cover. So this is how this plays out in practice. All right, so now let me say more about the mathematical apparatus that we use to capture this effect, the tidal deformations and dissipation. So, and this way I'm going to introduce the Love numbers. Okay, they were introduced by a British mathematician Love 100 years ago. So he considered the following problem. Imagine I have a fluid body that would be spherically symmetric in the absence of any external forces. And now imagine that I put some little perturbation. Let's say I have a satellite. And in this case, now I want to calculate what is the potential going to be, let's say, of this point that is, you know, with respect to the main body. So in the absence of the perturbation, my potential will be given by, you know, my just the monopole term, M over R. Now, if I have a perturbation, it will create some tidal forces. You know, if I'm interested in the vicinity, you know, in a point in the vicinity of a central body, I can approximate, well, I can Taylor expand my external potential into multiple moments. And, you know, the leading order one will be the, you know, the quadrupole moment. So this will be then the potential produced by the satellite. And then in response to this external perturbation, my central body will also get deformed, and it will produce some dipole moment, and then we'll have some quadrupole moment, and it will have some quadrupole contribution as well. And then in linear response theory, well, and okay, we can generalize this also to higher orders, you know, and we have this general picture that we have some tidal fields, and tidal fields, they grow as a function of R. So they sort of grow towards, like, as I go to my perturbation, their effect is growing. So this is what this growing tail means. And then there will be some tidal response that is captured here by the decaying tail. So there will be like 1 over R. This is a tail that corresponds to the induced multiple moments. Now, what Love did, he said, oh, look, let's describe this problem same way as we do with you know, E and M with electricity and magnetism. So let's say that in linear response theory, the size of my induced quadrupole moment should be linearly proportional to the external tidal field. and then I'm plugging here some typical radius, okay, Schwarzschild radius for black holes, just to make up for the dimensions. And then lambda will be a dimensionless parameter. And then he said, okay, this is, I'm going to call it like a number, and then obviously people after him call this a Laugh number. So that's the definition in Newtonian physics. It's a very, you know, very simple, very, I guess, you know, conceptually clear in the Newtonian context. However, the problem is, of course, that when we talk about gravitational waveforms, you know, we use GR, and GR is fully nonlinear. And so the question is, what do we actually measure in, with gravitational waveforms? And for so for that, we have to understand how to define a Laugh number in full GR context. So ideally, we want a definition that sort of matches the Newtonian one on large scales, you know, at large distances. But we also want a definition that is that respects the symmetries of GR, so that is diff invariant, that respects, let's say, reparameterization of my word line. And another question, conceptual question that appears is whether this, you know, nice vanilla picture that I described, that we have a source and a response, whether this picture actually makes sense in GR because GR is a fully nonlinear theory. And in fact, yes, spoiler is that this split of the gravitational field into source and response is not really well defined, and this is, so they mix, and this is something that produces a logarithmic running of Laugh numbers. So now I'm going to argue that the best way to define Laugh numbers in a full, you know, fully relativistic context will be to use the word line effective field theory developed by Goldberger and Rothstein. So what's the idea of this theory? So in for our in spiral problem, the typical physical situation that we deal with looks like this. So we have two compact bodies. These two compact bodies, they tidally deform each other, and then they rotate and emit some gravitational waves. And in full GR, it's an extremely complicated, you know, all this story is extremely complicated. We cannot calculate it exactly. So we have to work out some kind of approximate way of doing these things. And within the EFT, basically each of these separate stages, we separate and say that there is a characteristic scale that controls physics at this scale, and we then develop some sort of gradient expansion with respect to this scale. So for instance, the first part of my story that, you know, compact bodies are tidally perturbed, this is something that is controlled by the, well, typical scale, which is the size of the compact body. And well, the next stage will be the potential motion. So it's controlled by the, let's say the typical length scale is the orbital size, and then the radiation has a wavelength which is greater than that, and that's why, you know, this gives us the highest, the longest scale in our problem. So basically, we have to split the problem into three regions and solve in each region everything perturbatively. So I'm going to focus now on this first part of this program, which is the description of tidal effects using the EFT. So basically, the idea then is that at very large distances, at distances larger than the size of the my black hole, you know, or compact body, so this body looks like a point particle. So its action will look like this, just the usual point particle action. And then I can include, you know, some corrections on top of that using, you know, EFT methodology. And to, well, give you maybe some context, let me use word line, let me work out word line EFT for the electricity and magnetism, because in principle we have the exact same problem in this case. So imagine I have some charge distribution, and then I have some external field, electromagnetic field, that I described with my four potential, A mu. And then normally what we do in the context of A and M, we replace this complicated charge distribution with a collection of multiple moments. And basically you can think of the word line EFT as a way to efficiently generate these moments. So we know that at leading order, I can write down the following effective action that describes my point charge, so I, you know, and it's coupling to the external field, and this action is, you know, it respects all symmetries, it respects Lorentz, it respects the reparameterization invariance, and so on and so forth. And then if I want to include corrections beyond my monopole approximation, I have to write down next in order operator. And the only one that I can, you know, write down that satisfies all the symmetries will look like this. So it will have f mu nu squared, you know, with some funky powers of the four velocity that, you know, that is needed to compensate, you know, to ensure that this is a reparameterization invariant. And in the rest frame of my body, I can, you know, these things simplify. And well, here I will just see my usual coupling of the charge to the electrostatic potential, and here I will find the square of the electric field in the bodies in the charge rest frame. So, and then we can go on and we can write down more complicated operators that will describe other effects. And this EFT is, so all these couplings are non-renormalizable. So you can, for instance, estimate that this coefficient that appears here, chi, it has dimensions of length cube. So yeah, so it's non-renormalizable, but this is fine. So in principle, we have an infinite collection of these operators, but again, for a given, you know, fixed precision, we only need to keep track of a finite number of operators. So this is how we describe finite size effects for the E and M case. And one of the problems we can solve here is the response to an external field. So now imagine that I'm going to consider a neutral charge, well, some distribution whose total charge is zero. So then my effective action will look like this. I can also add Maxwell, my four-dimensional Maxwell action. And then let me say that my electric field has some external source, and then my word line will react to this source. So the total field will be the sum of the source and response. The Feynman diagram I can draw will be like this. So this is my word line, this is an external field, this is the total field that includes both external and the response. So if I now just plug this into my action, you know, vary it, solve the equations of motion, I'm going to find the following expression for the total electric field, well, assuming that it's spherically symmetric. So there will be a contribution that is constant that describes my source, and there will be something that looks like a contribution, like electric field of an induced dipole moment. So in this way, now you can say that, okay, this contribution that actually normally we write down like this. So this will be a dipole moment produced by, you know, the polarization, by the internal polarization of this charge distribution. So there will be an internal induced dipole moment linearly proportional to the external field, and chi will be, so my Wilson coefficient in this context will be just the usual polarizability parameter. So this way you can see how the EFT for E and M really, you know, can reproduce the standard, you know, E and M 101 calculations. But of course, you know, it's like, why am I doing this? Well, it's totally redundant. I can just use my, you know, E and M 101. So the point here is that, well, we just sort of work this out, see how it works for the problem so that we know the answer to, and then we can apply this to gravity where we don't know the exact answer. So for gravity, the situation will be exactly the same. So the logic is identical. So we have some point particle contribution to the gravitational potential that will, well, to the action that will look like this. And then the next Tolin order operator that is allowed by symmetries will be the square of the electric gravitational field that is, well, basically some contraction of the Riemann tensor with the four velocities. In the Newtonian limit, this will be proportional to the tidal tensor. So E mu will be just, you know, will reduce to di dj phi. So in some sense, in the Newtonian limit, we're back to a scalar field theory where, you know, this is like a scalar operator. And that's why, you know, in this context, basically scalar calculations in many instances will give you the full gravitational result. So sometimes, you know, I'll be showing you some result for a scalar just to simplify calculations.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
So I know you said there's just this kick with classical, not crazy physics, but like, let's say for general, I mean,
yeah.
So you said, suppose in gravity, the action were now new gravities, which is scalar plus some quantum length scale appropriately normalized, we reach a scalar to the fifth power. Mm-hmm. Would the argument tell you that you would write exactly the same effective? Because
yeah, for compact body, you would write, this is the action only for the compact body.
Right.
And on top of that, you still have jar, you still have some maybe corrections to jar. I will actually discuss some of these corrections, like what happens, for instance, with stringy corrections, something that I'm going to cover here. Yeah, so this is only the action for the compact body. Everything else, on top of that, you need to add the usual Einstein jar term. All right. So now, once you have this action, we can also play the same trick. We can do this, solve the same exercise. We can, fix a gauge, let's say Newtonian gauge. We have our action, and then we can solve the response problem. So let's assume that we have some external field, tidal field, and then we calculate the response of the word line to this tidal field, and we'll find the exact structure that we expect. So we'll see that it will be proportional to the tidal field itself times the Love number, times this coefficient lambda over some decaying tail. And now you can compare this with the definition introduced by Love, and you see that lambda, the Wilson coefficient that appears in my expansion here, exactly matches the classical definition of the Love number. So basically this way you see that EFT provides a gauge invariant, a GR definition of Love numbers, because here it's just an operator, it's just a constant in some action that in principle is fully, gauge invariant in respect of symmetries of GR. So it gives a nice and ambiguous gauge invariant definition of Love numbers. So now, how are we going to measure, to extract Love numbers? So the way to do it is the following. It's to match the EFT calculations with the full GR. So here, in the context of the EFT, as I said, we have this hierarchy of scales, and the EFT in principle is applicable only for distances larger than the size of the compact body. But GR, as we know, is applicable also to all the way to the, let's say, Planck scale, right? So in the context of the EFT, GR is a UV theory. Then if we want to extract the Love numbers, what we need to do, we need to match EFT calculations to GR calculations. For example, imagine that we go in some suitably defined frame, local asymptotic rest frame introduced by Kip Thorne, and we can calculate. So in this frame, basically our gravitational potential generalizes the gravitational potential, says that in this frame it will be just the G00 in that particular rest frame. So we calculate the GR expression for the induced, the metric generated by the induced quadruple moment. We find some expression, and we do the exact same calculation in the EFT. We also find the expression that now depends on the Love number. We match, we see that lambda 2 is B. Okay, and after matching, basically, EFT has the property of universality that says that this coefficient that appears in the action is the same for all processes. So after we have extracted lambda 2, now we can use it everywhere. For instance, we can calculate the contribution of the tidal deformation to the flux. We can calculate, let's say, scattering amplitude, anything that we want. And this way, we maintain predictability, even though EFT depends on, as I mentioned, on the infinite number of Wilson coefficients. All right. So now I'm going to double down and say that not only we have to use the EFT to define Love numbers, but also we have to use scattering amplitudes to measure them. Because on the previous slide, I said, okay, let's define some frame and match some calculations in a given frame. But even this is slightly ambiguous because sometimes, it's very hard to make sure that, the gauges that you use on both sides, they exactly match like at a given post-Newtonian order. So in principle, of course, we can match this, and this is what has been done to match, let's say, gravitational potential, the Newtonian potential. So that will be, in the EFT speak, this would be the matching of the off-shell one-point function, or like the expectation values of the fields, which is fine to match, but then, we still have to define some coordinates and frames. And even though there was a lot of progress in this, there was a very nice paper by Eric Poisson, discussed this with him, how to define a frame in which you can should define your multiple moments, and the multiple moments are should be appropriately defined. And so this is all very good, but still, this sort of frame dependence and coordinate dependence introduces some difficulties. So it's not easy to then understand what happens at the level of the waveforms. So I want to calculate this EFT, sort of the approach eventually to calculate the waveforms easily, okay? So if I define something in one particular frame, it's not obvious to me what happens to the waveforms. You can understand that this can be alleviated with the EFT because we can match in the EFT some gauge invariant quantities, such as the on-shell scattering amplitudes. Because they will be described, the scattering will be described by the exact same action. And if we manage to match the amplitudes, we'll get our Love numbers in a way that is totally independent from gauge, coordinate, or field redefinition dependence. So, and then again, the property of the EFT universality will guarantee that once Love numbers are matched, then you can use them to make further predictions for other processes. So yeah, now let me say a few words about the amplitudes. Again, let's go back to the case of the electricity and magnetism. So this was my action. Imagine I want to now describe the scattering of light, you know, of my some atoms, let's say nitrogen atoms in the air, using the same action. So I can easily do that, and I will see that the leading order scattering amplitude will be simply proportional to chi, my polarizability, times omega squared, and grows with frequency. And that means that the, you know, light, that the skies are blue, and, you know, everything is great. You know, I can say that this result can be derived, it's like enforced by the symmetries. You know, it's all very nice because this is the only operator that I can write down for a neutral system. So symmetries tell me that the light should be blue. And this is something that I assume like everyone is familiar with. So with gravitational waves, now the picture is exactly identical to that. So we have our action. Now let's calculate the scattering of this action. And this local operator then will generate a contribution to the amplitude that will scale like this. So lambda 2 times r to the fifth power, so this is my Wilson coefficient, times omega to the fourth power. So you see it's very similar. The scattering of gravitational waves is, of compact object is very similar to the scattering of light of atoms in the air. Well, the problem, though, is that for light in the air, we, you know, if the atom is neutral, then the contribution from the local counter term is the only contribution is to the scattering amplitude that you care about. Well, here it's not the case because we also have the point particle contribution, right? So first, now if I want to calculate the scattering of, let's say, light or gravitational waves of a compact body, it will be dominated by the scattering of the point particle contribution and then, you know, scattering of two-point particle contributions and so on and so forth. And the finite size effects will only appear at very high post-Newtonian order. Well, in fact, here in this context, the expansion that we're doing is post-Minkowski, so we formally expand in the strength of the Newton's gravitational constant. So this contribution, for instance, will be linear in G, this contribution will be G squared, and so on and so forth. And we can power count that the finite size effects that appear here, so they will, so their contribution will be proportional to the radius of a compact body to the power 12 plus 1. L is the orbital number, you know, the multiple moment. And in principle, okay, if we go in general number of dimensions, this will scale like some strange power of G, you know, G to the power 2L over D minus 3 plus 1. So that means that in general, these expansions sort of don't overlap in general number of dimension, or like this contribution is not part of the post-Newtonian expansion, but it becomes one in the actual physical number of space-time dimensions, 4. So here if I plug D equal 4, this will be just 2L plus 1. L is the multiple moment, it's also integer. So there will be some overlap. So that makes that will make things hard for me because like there will be always this interference between post-Newtonian and finite size contributions. But however, this can be avoided if instead of analytically continuing in the number of space-time dimensions, I analytically continue in the angular momentum L. So in this case, I can maintain this separation, and this is a standard trick that we use in field theory as the, you know, Frossard-Grieber formalism. So in this case, my final, let's say, the scattering amplitude that I'm going to get for my Raman scattering process will look like this. It will scale like powers, integer powers of G, so this will be standard post-Newtonian, and then finite size counter terms, they will produce corrections that scale as G to some power to L plus 1, and then this doesn't overlap for general L and everything is fine. So there could be some subtleties in the actual physical limit. So sometimes you can have divergences, and actually we showed that these divergences then will correspond to the case where there's an actual overlap between these two things. So one has to be careful with the Frossard Grieber formalism here, but in principle, let's say at leading order there is absolutely no subtlety, everything works very, very nicely. All right, so this is how we how we do that. We calculate scattering amplitude in the EFT and compare it with the scattering amplitude in full general relativity. So, okay. Now, in terms of the expectation values for these Wilson coefficients, based on dimension analysis, we expect them to be order one numbers. And also, as I mentioned on the previous slide, we expect, in general, something like the classical RG running. So in other words, I have this diagram that contributes to a given post-Minkowski order. You know, this is a contribution of the finite size effects. But then I can write down a multi-loop diagram. So for gravity in four dimensions, this will be a five-loop diagram that gives a contribution that scales the same way. and in principle, it produces a log running of my contraction. So then one expects, you know, as normal in the EFT, that it will have some running. You know, oh, some coefficients run, this is standard, it's all good. So, all right, those are our expectations. And now for black holes, you know, for the most relevant case, in the context of LIGO, we can actually solve this static tidal problem, or we can also solve the scattering problem, the classical scattering problem exactly. And we can actually compare the results of the full jar, which is our EV theory, with the expectations of the EFT. And then what we find is that actually none of this happens. So the Loft numbers are not order one and they don't run. So now let me tell you what is Loft. So these calculations that we had imply that in four dimensions, the Loft numbers are identically zero. And this is actually true for all fields, electromagnetic, gravity, and scalar fields. So black holes appear, you know, to be extremely boring objects. You apply an external gravitational field or some external electric field, and they just don't care, right? They don't polarize, they don't do anything. But however, this all changes in higher number of dimensions. So if we could go to, you know, more dimensions, then the relevant parameter in our calculation would be this generalized angular momentum that you've already seen before. So it will be L over D minus 3. So L is the orbital number. And in that case, the behavior of Loft numbers will depend on the value of L hat. So for integer L hat, which is, you know, always true in four dimensions, Loft numbers will still vanish. Then for general L hat that is not integer, not half integer, you will find a constant contribution that will look like this. And then for half integer L hat, you will have a divergence here. You have to renormalize it. You will find some log running as you expected. So you see it's a very strange behavior that, again, sort of violates your naive dimensional analysis. So it all seems very unnatural from the Wilsonian point of view. So this calls for some kind of explanation, symmetry explanation that I'm going to give you shortly. Now, let me make one comment about the Kerr black holes. So we have Schwarzschild black hole solutions, which are totally stationary. We have Kerr black hole solutions which are rotating. In this case, so they have spin. In this case, spin will be my extra degree of freedom that I need to include my EFT. And the way to do it is the following one. So first of all, of course, I have less symmetries. So I don't have the spherical symmetry of Schwarzschild black holes. So my EFT now only has like an azimuthal symmetry. So that means that my Wilson coefficients has to be promoted to some sort of tensors. Right, so my Loft number will be a tensor now. Okay, this is fine, this is easy to do. But then, in addition to that, I also need, turns out that for Kerr, this is really important, I also need to incorporate the degrees of freedom that live on the black hole horizon. And I do so by writing down some composite operator, OAIJ, that parameterizes the effect of horizon degrees of freedom on large scales. And then I couple it with my tidal field. And then if I calculate now, well, now the presence of this operator will renormalize my response contribution. So there will be a two-point function of this operator, or roughly I will have a diagram that look like this. So there will be a renormalization of the Loft number due to this two-point function. And if I work out the expression for this operator in position space, I will see that it will be proportional to, well, some constant times dt plus omega d phi, where omega is the angular velocity. Acting on the external tidal field. And you can see that from this expression that actually even if, you know, for Kerr, even if my perturbation is totally static, so dt is zero, I will still have some contribution from the horizon degrees of freedom that is associated with this d phi term. And actually what you see here is the time derivative is in the co-rotating frame. And this is something in the context of scattering amplitudes will produce a super radiance factor that will look like this omega minus m times capital omega. All right. So this is a little technical subtlety that, you know, has to be done if you work with Kerr. And again, you can, you know, we can match also the absorption cross section, and this way we can extract the imaginary part of this operator. All right. And maybe let me just say that. So because of this subtlety, there was some confusion in the literature whether Loft numbers of Kerr black holes are zero or not. But once you, you know, in the EFT, once you work out, you put this operator, you work out this. You can actually show that this original contribution, the conservative effect of this operator is still zero. And this is something that we derived with Sergei Dubovsky, Panisher ensembles long ago, and this helped us settle some argument in the literature that was sort of going on back then. And this was very timely because, you know, this is one of the results that we used directly by the LIGO collaboration in their analysis.
So you're saying the kernel members with top number is zero? Okay.
Yeah, like this, this is zero. Yeah, this is not. And people were confused because they obtained this and they interpret this as a Lough number, but in fact, like as a dissipative effect. So it contributes to the flux. All right. So let me also make a comment about dynamical Lough numbers. So these are like some generalization of Lough numbers, of static Lough numbers. So they, in the EFT, they are parameterized by operators that look like this, like derivative of the gravitational-electric field squared. Also for care, you can write down an operator that will look like this. It's a conservative operator as well. So it has only one derivative of E, but it has a spin degree of freedom here. So it's not a total derivative anymore. And something that we also did, we calculated the running of these operators, and the result you can see here. So here maybe the point that I want to make is that for dynamical Lough numbers, there is no fine tuning. They are perfectly natural. So they are non-zero, they run. In AFT, this running can be easily incorporated as a running of coupling constants. But there is nothing interesting here in the sense that everything is natural and everything is fine. So we matched the running, the beta functions first, and then using this Froissart Grybov trick, and then later on with Julio and collaborators, we calculated the full scattering amplitude for the Raman process, and we also matched the finite part. And then you will see really that the, for a scalar field, for this type of operator, for instance, the dynamical Lough number will really be some counter term, so we'll have some infinite part that will normalize some running, and then order one constant coefficient. So everything is perfectly natural. Yes. This will be like omega squared contribution to the Lough number, to the usual expression. Okay. So now let me say why do I, make such a big fuss about this naturalness? Why do we care at all? Because in some sense, naturals is, if something is unnatural, it sort of challenges the way we do physics, because we can do physics in many cases only because we already know the result before doing the calculation, right? And in these cases, we say that the result is natural. So let's consider a pendulum. So a pendulum has a bunch of parameters. We have the gravitational field strength. We have the length of the pendulum. We have the mass. But on dimensional grounds, we can say that our period will only be, square root of L over G. It will not depend on the mass, just because, dimensions will not work if I include the mass. So we know the answer. The answer is given in terms of the parameters of our system. Now let's take a look at this tidal problem that I described before. So we have also some typical parameters of our problem. We have the gravitational constant. We have the size of our central body. We have its mass. Again, on dimensional grounds, we expect that the Lough number will be given by the ratio of the mass over the radius, which is order one, if C is one. But instead, these are the normal parameters of our system, right? This is like really analog of that. But instead, if you ask the question, when the Lough numbers will be non-zero for a first time, like for real, right? Okay, in JAR, they're zero. Like, what makes them non-zero? You will find that this will be a two-loop correction to the Alstein-Hilbert action. And then the Lough numbers, the strength will be proportional to the Planck length divided by the size of the object to the fourth power. So it will be given by quantum gravity. So in this context, if I would say that the period is given by some quantum gravity, you would say that I'm totally crazy, right? But here yet, we have this strange situation. We have a perfectly classical gravitational problem, yet the result is given by quantum gravity. And that's why there must be some explanation for that. There must be some hidden symmetry. So let me explain now what this symmetry is. By the way, are there any questions at this point? No? Okay. So to understand the symmetry, we really need to understand what's going on with these JAR calculations in black hole perturbation theory. So here I'm showing you a cartoon done by one of the founders of the black hole perturbation theory. So this is basically what we do. We have some black hole. and we have some perturbation, a season end, you know, and then we just calculate its effect. And well, believe me, it's a very non-trivial fact, but the season end can be described as a Clairgerson equation in a black hole background. And another non-trivial fact is that actually, even for the Kerr black holes, this equation factorizes in terms of the radial coordinate, azimuthal coordinate, and polar coordinate. And this is something that is not warranted at all, because for Kerr, we don't have a symmetry that would naively split this, but yet it happens, okay? And in this case, so my Sneezing end, its equation of motion will take the form of the Schrodinger equation with some potential. So R is my radial wave function. And then the effective energy here will be proportional to L, will be given by LL plus 1, plus there will be some corrections due to finite frequency, but I'm always like in a small frequency limit that matches LIGO. Then there will be some metric function that depends on the outer and inner horizons. So the metric function goes to 0 as I approach the horizon. This is something important to keep in mind. Okay, so I have this Schrodinger problem. And I can solve the Schrodinger problem in the exact static limit. There's a full solution in terms of the Gauss hypergeometric function. And we see all the parameters here for Kerr. And now if I Taylor expand this solution at large distances, I will find some growing modes. So this really corresponds to my tidal forces, right? So my season end, I did a multiple expansion of him. So this is his tidal moments. But then I will not find any decaying tail. And this is the statement that I said before, that Loft numbers are zero, because naively I would expect that black hole would deform, but it doesn't, so no decaying tail. Okay, so now let me recall that I want to calculate a scattering problem. So that means that I have to include frequency into this problem. But if the frequency is non-zero, then this potential is too complicated and cannot be solved exactly. So the way how to do that will be to split the space, to split my space into two regions, the near zone region and the far zone region, calculate the solutions in both, and then match. So this is the cartoon picture of what is going on. There is my near horizon region is the smallest region that I have, but then I have a near zone region that is described by frequency, that is valid when frequency times the distance to the black hole is much less than 1. And I have my far zone region that really just really, really far away from the black hole. Okay, and then in each of these regions, I can work out the solution, let's say perturbatively over these small parameters. And if any fine tuning happens, it should happen in the near region, right? Because that's the only region that cares about the multiple moments of the black hole. Then the idea is that I need to take my full potential and split it into two pieces, the near zone piece and the far zone piece. So I do that and introduce some like this. I introduce some formal parameter epsilon that I set to 0 when I'm in the near zone region. And in principle, there could be many splits like this, and any of them will work as long as V0 is much greater than V1 in the near zone. And then I expect my solution to really look like a multiple expansion. And then also, what happens for a static problem is basically this V1 is always 0 at 0 frequency, so I have an infinite near zone. All right, so I do a split. In fact, it turns out that there is one particular split that is very nice. So here for reference, this is V0 that I should use, and this is my V1 that is left. And then if I do this split, a symmetry appears. I can write down vector fields that look like this. L0 is just proportional to dt, and then I have L plus minus that is a more complicated function, but again, it's some space-time vector. It has some R component, T component, and phi component for Kerr. And beta here is the inverse of the Hawking temperature. And what I find is that these vectors, they first of all, they are regular at the horizon. Second of all, they satisfy the SL2R algebra commutation relations, so I can easily check that. And then my Tikhovsky equation, right? My Tikhovsky equation is the Clairgerson equation for black holes. So can be, in this parameterization, can be written as just the eigenvalue problem for the Casimir of this algebra. So, and yeah, here is the Casimir. And from this, you can see that actually all properties of Loft numbers, right, that come from the near zone, they all should follow from a SL2R representation theory, because my Tchaikovsky equation basically enforcing the, or saying that my perturbation should satisfy this SL2R algebra. Yeah, at this point, let me say that this symmetry that I found is different from the very well-known Kerr-CFT symmetry introduced by Castra, Maloney, and Strominger, because the Kerr-CFT symmetry is also like the setup is similar. It also has a symmetry of the near zone perturbations, but then it's not defined globally. It's not well defined globally because it doesn't respect the periodicity of the azimuthal angle. It doesn't have a smooth Schwarzschild limit. So in this sense, the Loft symmetry that I have is different. It has a smooth Schwarzschild limit, and then it's globally well defined. So that means that physical solutions describing my black hole perturbations really form representations of SL2R. That was not the case in the for Kerr-CFT. Okay, so this symmetry is good because now I can make the statement that the black hole is the atom of the 21st century very accurate. So this statement was, well, I'm sure that you've seen it in many different contexts. There was an article written by my previous director, Robert Digraph, so I had to use his quote here. This was part of the contract. you know, we can make this statement now very accurate in a very precise technical sense. We can solve black hole perturbations using the operator algebra, just like for hydrogen, we can solve its energy levels also using the operator algebra that comes from SO3 plus the other SO3 that corresponds to the Runge-Lenz vector. So let me do that. And also, along the way, prove that Loft numbers vanish. So the relevant parameter of my representation theory will be the eigenvalue. Well, there are two things. The one which is the eigenvalue of the operator, the minimal eigenvalue of the operator L0. So L0 is dt. So obviously, the minimal one will be 0, right, by module. So this is, you know, that the static solution has that. And the second relevant parameter is the Casimir. And my you know, L that appears in the Casimir. And if it's integer, then automatically, well, I can open the math book, and then I will see that the representation that I have will be a highest weight representation. All right, so let me build this representation for the quadrupole case. So I start with some primary vector. So the primary vector is annihilated by L plus. I solve that, I get my V2. Then from there, I go down. I apply my lowering operators. So I apply it twice, I'm gonna get a state whose weight is zero. So this is my static solution. This is very nice. But now I can start from my static solution and go backwards. So I can go first, you know, apply twice the raising operator and make it a primary. And then the primary is annihilated by L plus. And then I can actually play the same trick for any L. So what I'm gonna find is that if I start with some static solution and for a given, you know, sector with a multiple number L, I act on it L plus one times, and this gives me the primary with L plus in front of it, and that will be zero according to the structure of my representation. Now, if I actually work out the explicit expression for these vectors, I will see that this operator will be simply proportional to the radial derivative to the power L plus one. That means that the solution of this equation is just a polynomial of R. And so you remember, before we did any of this, you know, symmetry stuff, we expected, so our guess would be that my solution would look like a growing tail plus Loft number over the decaying tail. But now we see that symmetry actually enforces the polynomial structure, right? So it says that the Loft number will be zero. So this is the result of the highest weight representation property.
So question, if you do this in high dimensions, then you are right.
Yes, that's exactly the my next slide. Or maybe after the next slide. Yeah, there are some nice things in terms of the dimensionality of the corresponding representation that tells you something about, you know, whether the solutions are stable on the white black hole horizon or the white hole horizon. But okay, I'm gonna skip that and go all the way to higher dimensions. So okay, in higher dimensions, what happens is that L hat is not integer anymore and the representation is not highest weight. So it means that in general, you don't have this algebraic constraint anymore, and that's why Loft numbers like should not be zero, and it's not zero. In the case when L hat is half integer, also from the EFT perspective, now you can have power counting allows for running to be present. So if Loft number is non-zero and running is possible, then you have, you know, full running, and this is how you explain the cases with the running. Well, this is slightly different from what happens in four dimensions, where in principle you could have running, but the symmetry tells you that the Lovs number must always be zero, and that's why even if, like, you could have running from the IR point of view, you know, the UV theory says that no running is possible. All right, maybe a last, okay. Yeah, several comments is, well, okay. The first comment is obviously, what is the relationship between the Lovs symmetry and the known isometries of black holes? We know that in the extremal case, for instance, if the black hole has a charge, like there is really an enhanced geometrical structure that appears in the near horizon region. So we can work out the Lovs symmetry also for the charged black holes, and we can see that, and it has a very similar algebraic structure. So the SL2R is the algebra of the anti-de Sitter space, or the isometry group of the anti-de Sitter space. So basically, what we can show is that Lovs symmetry in the limit of zero Hawking temperature carries over to the near horizon isometries of the black holes. So that's why there is always a relationship between them, and it gives some, let's say, holographic hints about the nature of the Lovs symmetry. And in fact, if you ask the question, what is the regime of the validity of this symmetry? And you plot some diagram, this will naturally give you some hint of the phase diagram. So here, there are a few parameters that are relevant. It's the Hawking temperature, frequency of perturbation, and the distance to the horizon. So I decided to use only a few of them, like omega over T Hawking here, and R minus R plus here, the distance to the horizon. So blue is the regime where Lovs symmetry is the actual isometry, is the actual symmetry of my space-time. So it's true when the Hawking temperature is zero, but also when the Hawking temperature goes to zero, but omega goes to zero faster. So in this case, it's an actual isometry, but of the near horizon region. And beyond that, at finite Hawking temperature and at finite distance from the horizon, it's not an isometry anymore, but it's a symmetry, it's a valid symmetry of perturbations that is valid in the near zone. So when omega times R basically is less than one. So this is this region. And this correspond to, so this corresponded to the case that we can interpret as some vacuum state where you know all symmetries are explicit, and that's why we have an isometry here. Whereas here, the you know from the field theory point of view, we have some finite Hawking temperature, so we have some sort of plasma, but we know that you know the symmetry should still be there. You know, finite temperature is broken only spontaneously. So in this sense, you can think that Lovs symmetry is a spontaneously broken isometry of the near horizon region. Right. So and it exists. Precisely because of that. It exists just mathematically. You can prove that because you have enhanced isometries in this region. All right. We explored many extensions of the Lovs symmetry. So we found that for the Kerr black holes, actually, there are multiple symmetries. One of them we call the Starobinsky symmetry because Starobinsky was first to use its equations. Well, Starobinsky unfortunately passed away in December last year, as you know. So the symmetry that describes it looks like this. It has a very similar structure, but for L naught we have this total, time derivative in the co-rotating frame. So it's a symmetry that is good specifically to study co-rotating perturbations. And then you can actually package Lovs symmetry and Starobinsky symmetry into one algebra that we call infinite dimensional extensions of Lovs. Its algebraic structure is a semi-direct product of SL2R and U1 vector. So in practice, you just take the vectors from SL2R and you supplement them with additional vectors that are proportional to d phi times some vectors from certain representations of SL2R, and then they could be of the original SL2R, and then they could be any coefficient in front of this. So this is the full symmetry structure of Kerr black holes. And then we explored the Lovs symmetry in higher dimensions. Well, Panas last month wrote a solo paper about this. There are many interesting things that happen in higher dimensions. Well, specifically in the example of Myers-Perry black hole, here I also must mention this, you know, at perimeter. One thing which is really nice in terms of the Myers-Perry black holes is that they have new types of fine-tuning. you have new selection rules. For instance, you know, we have this fact that Kerr black holes Luft numbers are zero and Schwarzschild black holes Luft numbers are zero. So this seems to be maybe is like sort of natural to expect if one is zero, the other one should be zero. So that is not the case for Myers-Perry. So Myers-Perry black holes are rotating black holes in five dimensions that have two axes of rotation. So in this case, in general, the Luft numbers are not zero, even if, you know, for static five-dimensional black holes, they can be zero. For rotating, they are not, unless the black hole is equirotating, so it's rotating with the same angular velocity along both axes, or the perturbations have equal magnetic numbers with respect to this axis. So it's a very strange selection rule, but we can explain this in the context of higher-dimensional SL2R. And also we developed some generalization in the context of P-brains that we'll publish with Panas soon. All right, you have this like more discussion about Kerr isometries, but I think I'm gonna skip that. Let me just say that this story that in the, you know, for Kerr, we also have an enhanced symmetry that, you know, we have some ADS2 space in the near horizon region and whose algebra is L2R. And so that is true also for Kerr. And for Kerr, we can recover this result from this infinite dimensional extension of the Lov symmetry. So the Bardeen-Horowitz symmetry group is part of this larger, well, infinite dimensional Lov family. And there could be, maybe I should also mention that there are other extensions. So there are more symmetries that were found by the group of Lam Hui and also recently by Uri Kohl at Harvard. So the story is not complete. I feel like the symmetry structure of black holes is still is bigger than what we have. Maybe the last few comments that I'd like to make is that, okay, I motivated all this story by the search of naturalness, for naturalness. So did I find naturalness? So can I say that Lov is natural now? It seems that not really, because what we have is not a full symmetry resolution in the sense of Hoft. We have some sort of UV miracle, because the symmetry that we have, Lov symmetry, it has this, there are these exponents with the Hawking temperature, and Hawking temperature is inversely proportional to the mass. That means that the states that are produced with the Lov symmetry, they're actually massive state, right? Whereas in the EFT, we're like in a low frequency approximation. So basically the cutoff of our EFT is M, and the symmetry produces states that are above the cutoff of the EFT. So in this sense, it's more, you know, from the EFT point of view, this is sort of a UV thing that is impossible to see. And that's why this particular resolution is really an example of the IR UV mixing. So it's. Yes.
Can you repeat the whole sentence? So you're saying.
Yes.
So you're saying the temperature, okay, it's inversely proportional to the mass. So the bigger the black hole, the lower the temperature.
Yeah.
So why does that imply the PL?
All right. Okay. I started it from the EFT perspective, right? The Hooft explanation would say the following, that you'd have, if you have a natural explanation, symmetry explanation, it means that, if some operator is zero, you have an enhanced symmetry in the IR. So that is not the case here, because this symmetry is a symmetry between a static solution and the massive solution, right? Like a static solution and quasi-neural modes. So quasi-neural modes are all above the EFT cutoff. We have integrated them out. It's like a symmetry between light particles and massive particles, and you have integrated out massive particles. And you have some constraints in the IR effect, in the IR theory, but then you will not be able to see the full picture, right? Because you have already integrated out UV modes. So it's a symmetry between IR and UV states. And that's why it's an example of IR and UV mixing.
Okay,
is it?
Why is it important that the temperature goes to zero?
In this context, yes, but in this case, okay, let's say that the Hawking temperature is finite, like for Schwarzschild, it's finite, right? It's proportional to the mass, right? And that's why we generate some states, and this is like, you know, a static solution, and then a bunch of quasi-neural modes are all above the EFT cutoff, right? So from the EFT point of view, you will not be able to see these states, right? So you'll not be able to see the emergence of the symmetry. So this is what makes it different from the Hooft scenario, because Hooft says that, oh, if you set some operators to zero, your Lagrangian will have more symmetries, and that's why it's natural for the certain operators to have small coefficients, right?
Yeah.
Now, this is not the case here, right? Because from this perspective, there is nothing in the EFT that tells you that it's more symmetric to have Lough number zero, right? Because there's a symmetry between IR and UV states in the full theory. We can discuss whether some sort of IR-UV mixing, I was thinking, could be useful for some other hierarchy problems. But I was thinking this conceptually is an interesting example. Right, I'm running out of time. So let me just say that there could be some practical applications of the symmetry as well. So the idea is we have some equations that we need to solve for, you know, LIGO, for LISA, you know, and these equations involve the full potential, but now we have some emergent symmetry when the, you know, only part of the potential is kept. So now we can sort of work out some perturbation theory around this exact solution. And maybe this is something that will help us calculate observables for relevant for LISA more efficiently. Okay, this is something that we're looking at right now. All right, so let me summarize my talk. I hope I've convinced you that Lough numbers are should be defined within the EFT as a Wilson coefficients, and you should use scattering amplitudes to extract them. So for Lough numbers, for black holes, Lough numbers are zero, and I propose an explanation to that that has some nice holographic interpretation and also opens up the possibility of this IR-UV mixing. And there could be some practical application in the context of boosting calculations relevant for gravitational wave science. So I think I will stop with that. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thanks very much, Misha. So are there further questions?
Yeah, so you mentioned the difficulty in trying to pick the Lough numbers. What exactly the waveforms? So do you understand how to connect this Lough number equals zero to, like, how to plug that into what actually happens when you have like Lough numbers?
Yeah. Now.
There's still some ambiguity there.
No, I think now we well actually. You see, the thing is that for the linear order Lough number, there was no mixing, like there was no running, and that's why, like, all prescriptions will give you the same result. So even before, you know, this EFT, people already used, you know, like Blanchard, you know, there were some Lough numbers in the LIGO waveforms that were calculated using the post-Newtonian methods, but they give you the exact same answer for the leading order Lough numbers. Now, for this dynamical Lough numbers, the story is different. I feel like we're still discussing how to implement this, because the LIGO people were discussing with Eric Poisson that there is zero, but the scattering calculation tells you that they're not, so we really have to understand what is going on at the level of the waveforms. But for the leading order Lough numbers, there's no ambiguity, and like the templates have been implemented. So for the neutron stars, this is exactly what was used. You have some templates, and Lough numbers parameterize like the tidal force. So basically, maybe at the very beginning, I was shown that it's possible to see anything. Let's see this diagram. Right. So this is the actual, let's say, template from neutron star analysis, and you see like the one that with zero Lough number and the one with some non-zero. So we know how to implement them.
Yeah, but I mean that's just this coefficient inference for right. The term. It's right. Like you're exactly.
Well, in the EFT, we know that the mapping is like really one-to-one, right? And we can, from this matching calculations, we can show that it's exactly the same coefficient that appears in the EFT. Right. Yes.
What happens to this double do compactification?
Say it again?
Compactification of either
actual dimensions
or
you mean then my gravity action will be different.
Yes.
Lough numbers in general will be non-zero. They are only zero specifically for Einstein jar. If you extend jar in any way, immediately the static Lough numbers will not be zero anymore.
So does that mean that if you have extra dimensions, you can get some correction to the Lough number like the size of the extra dimension
That's exactly right. the thing is, as I said, in the context of LIGO, the next to linear order operators, that is dynamical Lough numbers, are much stronger than any correction that you can expect from, let's say, particle physics or from compactification. So in reality, it will be impossible to extract them, right? Just because you don't have enough precision. But in theory, if you could have infinite precision, we can say that we could probe you know, quantifications, we can probe massive particles, anything that, you know, generates non-zero Lough numbers, like for real, after jar.
So in some scenario like IS2, like it would be the curvature scale which comes in?
Yeah. Well, look at it. Okay, anything smaller than, let's say, 1 kilometer, I think it will be extremely hard to probe. But 1 kilometer we can probe like here, right?
That's right. Okay, so let's stop here. Yeah. Thanks again, Misha.
Thank you.